Welcome to the archives of The Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. If you've never gone to a star party, I recommend that you go find your local astronomy club, and when they figure out an evening where there's no moon and they find some dark night sky, to go out and set up their telescopes and gaze up at the stars, be there. One of my favorites was going to Eastern Washington on a place called Table Mountain, where a lot of astronomers gather, and these were a lot of amateurs, mostly, and they set up telescopes so tall, so big, you had to climb a ladder to get up there to peer through the eyepiece, and you see amazing, amazing things. Nothing like getting out there and seeing it yourself, as opposed to on television or in pictures, some of these wonders of the night sky. And it's interesting to me how, though we can't reach out and touch the stars other than through touching the light that we receive, gazing up, using those telescopes, even binoculars, and our own naked eyes, that astronomy is one of the most accessible of the sciences, and it's there in that field where the amateurs are making some of the biggest impact. To celebrate that, our guest today has written Seeing in the Dark, How Backyard Stargazers Are Probing Deep Space and Guarding Earth from Interplanetary Peril. He's one of the most prolific authors and scientists, Timothy Ferris. You might have seen his other books, The Whole Shebang and Coming of Age in the Milky Way, or you might have seen on television his specials, The Creation of the Universe and Life Beyond Earth, which he wrote and narrated. And he joins us from the Bay Area today, where he's a professor at the University of California in Berkeley. Hello, Timothy. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Loralee. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what got you hooked on the stars at an early age?
It just kind of took for me when I was still quite young. I grew up in partly in rural Florida and then in Key Biscayne, down near Miami, and the skies there in those days were quite dark and inviting, and perhaps it was the beauty of the stars that got me involved. And in the course of working on the book, I asked a number of amateur astronomers how they had gotten started, and it was as difficult for them to say as it is perhaps to say, you know, why you married your spouse rather than someone else. But they would mention things like seeing the sight of Saturn's rings through a telescope. But whatever it is that sensitizes people to it, once you've gotten involved a little bit with the night sky, learned a few constellations, maybe seen a few things even through a small telescope, it seems to stay with you thereafter. It just seems to enrich people's lives permanently, and I'm hoping to do my part to increase the number of people who've had this delightful experience.
Tell us about the various star parties and what you can see, even with a pair of binoculars and some of the telescopes and those wonderful Dobsonian telescopes that make owning and using a telescope so easy and affordable for just about everyone.
That was an invention of John Dobson here in San Francisco, who was in a Buddhist monastery at the time and had no money or possessions, became interested in astronomy, and not being able to afford to buy a telescope or to make one in the traditional way, which was kind of expensive, John invented a series of techniques using found materials from the discard heap at construction sites and things of that sort. And thanks to his pioneering effort, from which he's always refused to apply for a patent or make any money, thousands of amateur astronomers today have really gigantic and yet affordable telescopes. I was talking to one of them who tows his telescope up into the mountains to get a better view, and he said that about half the galaxies he observes on a given night don't even have catalog numbers. They're so dim and distant. So So the Dobsonian telescopes, as they're called, have been one of the keys in revolutionizing amateur astronomers and putting technology in the hands of backyard stargazers that really is comparable to what the professional astronomers had in the era when their photographs really created our modern picture of the beautiful colors and so forth that one can see out there. So it's really an exciting time to be a stargazer.
It is. He has people grinding their own lenses too, doesn't he?
Yes, it's. There have always been these workshops at local science centers and so forth where you can grind a mirror. And John found that you could use much more ordinary glass than had been thought and still get acceptable results, and just put it together in a plywood box and a couple other inexpensive components. And as a result, I mean, there are backyard amateur astronomers today who have telescopes that, in terms of their performance, really rival that of the great Palomar telescope that revolutionized professional astronomy half a century ago.
At the star parties that I attend, there are some that have the standard ones that have a little motor that's set with Earth's rotation so that you can train it on an object and it'll compensate for the movement. So it always stays trained on that object. And the Dobsonian ones, you just have a easy gear, so you just keep shifting it over. But I understand you report that objects have been discovered because of the Dobsonian. They get out of the range of the viewing. People look through them and go, oh, there's something I hadn't seen.
Yeah, it's true. Comets,
yeah.
Hale-Bopp was discovered accidentally by a couple of stargazers within an hour or two of each other, and quite accidentally, it happened to be near a star cluster that many amateurs look at, and one of them was had taken a look at the cluster, and then the rotation of the Earth had caused it to drift out of the field, and suddenly there was this other thing in the field, and it proved to be one of the brightest comets of the 20th century. The discovery of comets is one area where amateurs have made a lot of contributions, and another is in discovering asteroids. Only about half of the kilometer class asteroids, that is, the ones that are big enough to do serious harm should one hit the Earth, have as yet been discovered and their orbits analyzed. And so the professionals are relying on the amateurs for help in continuing to discover these objects and in making enough images of them so that their orbits can be charted and it can be determined that they're safe. The odds of our being hit by an asteroid in any given year are a big one.
Astronomical.
Or astronomically small. But the consequences can be quite devastating. Impacts in the past have exterminated more than 90% of the species of life on land here. So it seems prudent to understand these objects better, just as a kind of insurance policy for our planet.
Would it really work if we were to send out some nuclear missiles or something and try to blast it out of the sky before a near-Earth approaching object got too near?
Well, actually, if you look at it from the standpoint of a wandering asteroid millions of miles away, the Earth is a pretty small target. And so once an asteroid is identified that is on a collision course to Earth, typically we would have years in which to address the problem. And in that situation, you don't have to do anything as dramatic as trying to blow it up. Actually, a much better technique is just to put a small rocket engine on that asteroid, fire it so that you alter that orbit a little bit, and then follow the orbit, see what you've done, make sure that you've gotten it a safe distance away. And so it's really rather a peaceful
solution.
Yeah. If you just blow them up, the problem is that you kind of replace a bullet with a shotgun load of fragments, and those fragments are still, many of them, going to hit the Earth. So it's better just to nudge them onto a different path.
That seems much more doable than target practice, where you're actually going to hit your target so far out. So it's really just the number of eyeballs and the number of hours that you have from a huge amateur workforce that is helping to discover objects and protect Earth here.
Yes, the, the big professional telescopes like the Keck telescope in Hawaii and the Palomar telescope and the big ones in the Chilean Andes are very powerful, and they're capable of doing things that the amateurs can't. But there are only a few of those telescopes. They typically have very narrow fields of view. And that leaves a lot of astronomy to be done with more modest instruments.
And there's a lot to see at this near shore, as you call it, as opposed to the deep waters of deep space.
Yes, for instance, the what's called the Kuiper Belt, a kind of second asteroid belt out past the orbit of Neptune, where you have things that are sort of like asteroids, but they're icy and pristine. They're very interesting as survivors of the formation of the solar system, so their study can help astronomers understand how the solar system got to be the way it is today. One of these Kuiper Belt objects was discovered recently by some kids at a school in New England using the Internet to make observations, to make electronic images with the telescope at the Leuschner Observatory over here at Berkeley. There's a project called Hands-On Universe that puts telescope time in the hands of students. And these students made an important discovery. So one of the emerging things that's going on in amateur astronomy is the using the Internet to make observations with telescopes that can be on the other side of the world, and you mm-hmm. don't have to go and visit them. I think it's very exciting, not only for science, but for education. I mean, personally, if I had a choice between dissecting a frog or possibly discovering an asteroid, you know, I'd rather try to discover
an
asteroid.
It's an easy choice.
Itself.
Yeah.
I'm always in favor of maximum choice for people.
Let's preserve life on Earth, including those frogs, too. So, I understand that there are even stargazing communities out there. I know that at the star parties, which would last over a long weekend, that you had to use was it yellow or red light so that you wouldn't disturb and add more light to the atmosphere at night?
Well, most stargazers use red lights.
Red lights,
the
okay.
energy level is low, and so it doesn't dazzle your eye. Anyone who wants to get out there, even if it's just to learn some constellations or teach constellations to a child, best thing is to use a red light. You can just take a plastic wrapper from a loaf of bread. If it's got some red on it, you know, and a rubber band, and tie that around the lens of an ordinary flashlight. Get the light dim enough so that you can see the star chart, but your eyes aren't dazzled. And give your eyes about 20 minutes to adjust to the dark so you can see everything. And you get a much better view that way.
Oh, it's such a blast to go out there, and there's hundreds of people, and they're all using your red flashlights so you can go from one telescope to the next. And you just go from telescope to telescope, and everybody's got it aimed at a different object, whether it's, I saw the rings of Saturn, I saw Jupiter, going over the different years, different planets are in view. And then people have their favorite constellations out there, and they give you a big, quick history of them, and you stand in line and chat with people while you're waiting your turn. It's just the most fun. What are some of these communities out there? I'd imagine they'd have lights off at dusk so people can get out there with their telescopes, and they're out in the middle of nowhere where there's far from lights.
Yes, there's a new field of founding astronomy communities. Chiefland, Florida was one. There's one now starting up in New Mexico where amateurs will get together and they'll buy some land in a remote dark sky location and subdivide it and sell the parcels off to their fellow amateurs. And what you have is a good sky and a guarantee your neighbors aren't going to be putting on any bright lights.
And hey, you can talk about your passion with everybody there.
That's right. And also when you're not there, because so many telescopes now are run by computers. Once you have a telescope that you can operate from a laptop through a cable, then you can operate it in theory from anywhere in the world over the Internet. So when you're not at...
You can still collect data.
Yeah, when you're not there, you can still do observations robotically, and a lot of stargazers have been getting into that technology.
Oh, how fun. So... What did those students discover, by the way? You said that those students made an important discovery.
They discovered a Kuiper Belt object, a big icy minor planet, what's called a trans-Neptunian object. this was, these things are dim, and it was thought to be beyond the reach of most amateurs, but here some science students were able to not only make the image, but to correctly interpret it,
wow,
to find it on the pair of images, and to realize that its relatively slow motion, orbital motion, meant that it was far away, out way beyond the asteroid belt, which I imagine looked pretty good on their college applications.
I would think so. I think what Galileo would be doing today, if he could just step into our times with all of the equipment that he never had.
Galileo was a pretty good telescope maker. I imagine he'd have some pretty fancy homemade gear working nowadays.
Yep. When we look out at the night sky, what are we seeing besides other planets that we didn't know were there? We can see the signatures of water. We know that's everywhere in the universe, even amino acids that are the building blocks of DNA. We get a sense that life just isn't a fluke here on Earth, that it's really abundant everywhere.
Well, life certainly started quite early in the evolution of this planet, and as you say, the building blocks of life, the complex molecules on which life is based, starting with carbon, other organics, are found throughout the universe. Some of the most beautiful sights through telescopes are these bright nebulae along the spiral arms of the galaxy where new stars and planets are forming. And those clouds are full of these organic molecules. So for me, one of the reasons that is fascinating to keep observing and studying the stars is that it's not just a matter of things that are out there and separated from us. We're in the universe, and the galaxy that we observe around us is the system that has created, among other things, us. So it's partly a matter of understanding our own human origins and evolution as well.
And the big picture.
Yeah, I mean, we're part of this big picture, and that's I've never quite understood the complaint that astronomy makes one feel insignificant. If you grow up in New York and you discover that you're a resident of one of the biggest cities in the world, I don't think that makes you feel insignificant, and neither does it to find that we live in a magnificent spiral galaxy of a couple of hundred billion stars.
Well, I guess if you realize that our sun is just an insignificant, smaller star and we're out in some backwater portion of an arm of a galaxy, but actually I think it's safe here. I wouldn't want to be at the center of the galaxy. I wouldn't want to be in any more active place.
Well, the center of the galaxy is a lot brighter. You'd have hundreds of stars bright enough to cast shadows, so it might interfere with the nice view that we have. We happen to be drifting through a bubble. When humans came along, the solar system is and was in the middle of a bubble blown out of the interstellar gas by an exploding star sometime in the past. So that gives us an unusually good view of distant galaxies, and even with a pair of binoculars, you can see light that is tens of millions of years old, and with a small telescope, you get up to hundreds of millions of light years away that you can see galaxies. And in the case of quasars, light that is billions of years old. So yeah, I think it helps to expand one's sense of time as well as space to do a little stargazing.
That's where the past really is much more accessible to us, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the astronomy, it doesn't allow you to see our own past, but otherwise it's very much as if there was a machine down at the history department on campus where you could look into it and you could see the Socrates, preaching at the Agora. When you can't get away from the fact that in astronomy you're seeing things as they were in the past. So at extreme distances, when you're watching galaxy formation and things like that, it's really possible to directly observe the history of the universe in action. This is a powerful way to check on theories. The reason the Big Bang theory, for instance, is so widely accepted among scientists is not just because it's a coherent story that seems to fit together, but because it's passed a number of these observational tests. And I find it amazing myself that here there's one species on this, as you say, a planet in an unexceptional location in an ordinary galaxy, has been able to
figure out
this much about the universe in such a relatively short amount of time.
What do you see for the future of astronomy when we have bigger, more powerful instruments to see with? We have other means of detecting what the story is out there through capturing and analyzing other forms of energy on the electromagnetic spectrum. What do you see for the future? What can we know in the future, do you suppose?
Well, there are a lot of exciting prospects, and one that's right on the horizon is the searching for evidence of life on other planets. We now have dozens of stars that are known to have planets. It was long speculated that planets were commonplace, but we now have direct evidence that
we can see them.
Yeah, you can see evidence that they're there. And NASA is about to launch a project involving amateur astronomers to find more extra solar planets, as they're called. And as these techniques improve and we're able to detect planets as small as the Earth, so far it's only been good for detecting big Jupiter-sized planets. Once we start detecting Earth-scale planets, then there's going to be an opportunity to take spectra of these planets and look at their chemical composition, start looking for signs of life. And, if the day comes when a planet circling another star has been identified that shows signs of having life on it, then we're going to be in a whole different phase of this drama.
I assume that NASA would celebrate that day because it would mean that they could then go and ask for a lot more money for their budget and have popular support behind it.
Well, the NASA budget has been flat in constant dollars for a long time, and I don't know if it's going to be increased necessarily, but certainly the way you allocate that money within the budget could be improved. We're spending so much of the budget currently on the space station, on operations in low Earth orbit, and those have some benefit, but obviously, being able to compare the Earth with other planets that have life is a much more exciting prospect.
I know you're a consultant to NASA on the long-term goals of space exploration. Do you suppose that we'll be sending people out to colonize, or will it all be done robotically and through probes?
I think people are destined to go into space if we have the good fortune to be presented with a sufficient opportunity and to be able to muster the backing. Exploration has always been expensive. You recall how much trouble Christopher Columbus had raising money to
sail. Oh, good analogy.
But I think that there certainly are good arguments for colonizing Mars. If there's not life on Mars now, humans would clearly be in a whole lot more secure situation if we lived on two planets rather than one. So there's an immediate invitation to colonize Mars. And then in the long run, very interesting prospects about whether one could seed other planets with life or live on other living planets. The boundary line between science fiction and real science seems as if they're going to, very possibly the goalposts are going to get moved again as they have been in the past.
Are you a fan of science fiction that explores those possibilities?
I was. When I was a teenager, I read hundreds of books of science fiction. I'm a great admirer of the imagination you find in them. My specialty is English literature, so after a while, once you start reading Dostoevsky, it gets a little harder to put up with the literary style of all the science fiction.
But, where's the Shakespeare of the sci-fi world, huh?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few, a few good writers in this field, but it's particularly a great field when you're an adolescent, and you're more forgiving, perhaps.
Are you a fan of Star Trek?
Oddly enough, I've never seen an episode of Star Trek.
No.
I don't know why that is, but I assume that it's. I saw one of the movies. I was caught in the rain once in New York, and I ducked into a movie theater. I couldn't get a cab. And it was one of the Star Trek films, and it turned out to be to involve the Voyager space probe. And I had produced the record on Voyager, so I was kind of interested in that. But I'm afraid I'm a kind of a Star Trek illiterate.
Tell us about your work on that, because you're also big in the music. And so were you selecting the what would this message be? To give us your whole stance when we come back from the break on, should we communicate? What would we communicate to that life that's we're gonna eventually find this out there,
sure,
that's intelligent? And how do you put a package together to send to them? How do you get over the communication barrier? As we continue with Timothy Farris, you might want to check out his most recent book, Seeing in the Dark, How Backyard Stargazers Are Probing Deep Space and Guarding Earth from Interplanetary Peril. Right back. I'm Laura Lee. Let's continue our conversation with astronomer Timothy Farris. Why were you contacted to put that part of the message together, and what's the strategy? How to communicate with ET should they find?
NASA has launched 4 planetary probes, instrumented spacecraft, to the outer planets, which, by virtue of being accelerated in velocity when they pass the planet Jupiter, it's kind of crack the whip effect, have been flung out of the solar system. They are interstellar spacecraft. And Carl Sagan and Frank Drake and others put a plaque, you may recall, on the first 2 of those probes, which tried to provide some information about who had dispatched the space probe.
This is what we look like. This is where we are in relation to our own solar system.
Exactly. And yeah. With the Voyager, which was a larger spacecraft, there was an opportunity to make a larger plaque, and as people were discussing early on how to put a lot of information on a plaque, they realized that if you made a metal phonograph record, you could etch this information into the groove. So we made a record that was 3/4 music and also contains photographs and natural sounds of the Earth. And it's a kind of a time capsule expected to last a billion years. I'd always had an interest in music as well as astronomy. These are 2 threads that have been intertwined through much of history. And so when Carl asked me to produce the record, I was happy to have this unusual opportunity to do something musical in an astronomical project.
A couple of questions. What did you choose in terms of music and natural sounds? And how is it actually engraved on this?
Well, the music is engraved just as in a traditional phonograph record, except it's made of metal.
How would they play it? How would, you know, aliens discover this? What are they going to play it on?
Well, we included a phono cartridge, so you could actually start the process. It's not much of a technological challenge for anyone who's capable of snaring an interstellar space probe.
To figure it out.
And yeah, there's the rotation rate for the record, which is half normal speed. It's 16 and a third RPM record. Are engraved on the casing in terms of the transition time of the hydrogen atom, so it's pretty universal time scale. Of course, we have no idea what the odds are that someone would eventually find this record over the next billion years.
Well, with that much time, you just need one opportunity, don't you? Just need it
right
to happen once.
And in any case, I thought it was a good exercise in looking at our own planet as a planet, as a one world, rather than a collection of nations or cities. And I think we did a pretty good job, really, of representing a little bit of the diversity of the world's music. And it's quite a musical place, this planet that we live on.
It is. And the number of animals that sing songs as well.
Yeah, we put some of them on, too. It has some whale songs, birds. And
so, world music, what'd you choose?
Well, it's a bunch of pieces from all around the world. There's an ancient New Guinean song. There is a Chinese Qin piece called Flowing Streams, which is also old and quite beautiful. Japanese shakuhachi, Balinese gamelan, Beethoven and Bach and Mozart from the European tradition.
Uh-huh.
American blues, Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good. Quite a wide range of music.
Do you suppose that some alien culture would think, aha, let's find the mathematical message embedded in this?
Well, there are some messages embedded, you know, and that's why we stressed Bach a bit, the 3 pieces by Bach in there, because Bach's music is full of mathematical
harmonics.
So that even if the music means nothing to you, you can see that there's an underlying logic in it.
Yep. You also profile in your book a number of other interesting characters out there doing their part. Who are some of your favorites?
Well, Barbara Wilson, who's lives in down Houston and had an ordinary career as a housewife and business executive and so forth, but was always interested in amateur astronomy and got back into it in the middle stages of her life. She turned out to be one of the world's most acute visual observers, been able to see things that people hadn't thought was possible to see with the eye through a telescope. And
such as?
Barbara has seen the plasma jet emerging from a black hole near the center of giant elliptical galaxy M87.
My.
She has tracked these long, dark nebulae that wind through the Milky Way. Not too much attention had been paid to them before. She's corrected the professional cataloging of at least one major star cluster. And she's helped to encourage a lot of other stargazers to test the limits of what they can see. Amateur astronomy 20 years ago or so, most folks only had small telescopes and could see just sort of standard bright objects, the rings of Saturn, craters on the moon, things like that. Now that amateurs have bigger telescopes, it is becoming clear that there are challenges here and things that you can see that hadn't really ever been thought to be within the reach of visual observers. Good example of that is Steve O'Meara in Hawaii, who as a teenager was given the keys to the Harvard College Observatory.
Oh, that's an interesting story, isn't it?
He was such an enthusiast at that age. And Stephen determined, for instance, the rotation rate of Uranus, which was unknown at the time, using the Harvard telescope and the backyard telescope. And the professional astronomers, using much more, much bigger, fancier equipment, got a different value for the rotation period of this planet, which is hard to determine because it's a featureless gas planet. And then when the Voyager spacecraft got there and determined the correct figure, it turned out that Steve had it right in the first place.
Seth Sostak has talked to us about the SETI project in which amateurs are taking part in as well with their computers. Tell us a bit about that.
The Seth Sostak would be SETI, I believe.
Right, the SETI project.
Well, of course, one big advance in SETI has been SETI at Home, in which you can download a screensaver for your computer, which will use your computer when it's idle to run what are called Fourier transforms on raw data collected, particularly by the Arecibo radio telescope, the world's largest radio telescope. Searching through all that natural radio noise out there in the universe for some sign of an artificial signal from another technologically advanced planet. SETI at Home has proved to be a huge success, and so many computers, millions of them, are now running this program that taken together they amount to the most powerful computer yet assembled on this planet. So that's been a good example of where democratic science, you know, science being done by lots of people just for the fun of it, can have a real valuable
impact.
Result.
And he said they've gotten interesting signals, but nothing repeatable.
No, so far we haven't heard from anyone, but you have to keep in mind that there are a lot of stars, a lot of frequencies that a radio signal might come in on and so forth. So it's SETI is a small-scale project as science goes, and it's paid for entirely by private funds. And so I think that's really the way to go is with a modest program. It's not a war on anything, and doesn't require a lot of taxpayer money. It does take patience, and you have to not get discouraged because it's a big universe that you're searching through.
don't expect immediate answers. Yeah.
No, it's when you're first starting in SETI, it's easy to have hunches. You say, okay, let's check out that star. You know, I have a feeling that's the right one. But you soon find in astronomy the numbers are overwhelming, and it takes a methodical approach, and often takes decades to before you can begin to say that, well, maybe there isn't anyone out there, or maybe we're going about this in the
Well, the fact is that it would take an immense amount of time for signals to be communicated back and forth across deep space.
Yes, and everyone involved knows that, and this has led me to think about what you do knowing that. Part of the answer is that I expect that messages received from other worlds would be quite long and quite rich in content. They're not like telephone conversations. They're more like writing a book to be read hundreds of years from now.
Because dialogues are hard.
Yeah, it's not a medium for conversation, but it can be a medium in which you can learn a great deal. Our galaxy is here for over 10 billion years, and even if civilizations only emerge at a modest rate, that still would add up to a lot of civilizations. And even if most of them are gone now, it may be that they've left records from which we could learn a great deal. You know, the ancient Greek society and the ancient Egyptians and the Sumerians are gone too.
But
they left messages. And, you know, we continue to learn from Homer and Socrates and the Sumerian astronomical records and so forth to this day.
Are we not, in effect, also broadcasting our message out into space, though it may not, you know, be the message that we want when we broadcast radio and television signals around our planet?
Yes.
But they also leak into the universe at large?
Yes, all the television and radio broadcasts here on Earth have, although some of them are quite weak, they have leaked out into space and are traveling through space at the velocity of light.
So. May not be the first impression that we want to make, but...
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, people bemoan the fact that I Love Lucy might be the first message that people got from Earth. But if you have a I Love Lucy on one hand or an earnest speech by the Secretary General of the United Nations on the other, I'm not sure which is really tells you more about us.
That's true. I'm not sure the UN speech would be what I'd want as a first representation either. But so do you think that we'll actually, traveling around our own solar system to the next door planet is one thing, but do you think we'll ever get out of our own solar system and over to Andromeda?
Well, it's the distances are very large, and I think what happens is that you start thinking about very different sorts of payloads. If, for instance, suppose there was an Earth-like planet discovered just 100 light years away, and that seemed a suitable abode for life, but for some reason had no life on it, you could send a probe to that planet, but to make the fuel bill affordable, you'd want it to be quite small. So, rather than sending some kind of galleon located, loaded with hundreds of colonists who are willing to spend 100 years in transit, it might make more sense to send a seed parcel, just the seeds of life to start life going there, or to send instrumented probes to take a closer look. It's long been understood that it's within the capacity of civilizations to send tiny probes to other planetary systems, and one of the arguments against this has been, well, how come we don't find one here in the solar system? The answer to that is that if there was a probe the size of a softball embedded on the far side of a metallic asteroid...
That's finding a needle in a haystack.
Yeah, it could have been here for hundreds of millions of years sending data back to its home planet. We would have no way of knowing it was here.
Interesting. What do you think the chances are that ETs are out there, or the ETs have visited, as so many people are wont to say, and...
Well, there's no evidence that we've been not enough evidence to get a murder indictment in Texas that we've ever been visited by aliens. If they have been here, they seem to have bagged their trash and left no trace. But I don't know what the odds are that there are, say, 10,000 civilizations in our galaxy today, as some astronomers conclude, or if the number is one and we're it, as other astronomers have argued. But I do know that we're not going to find them if we don't look for them. We tried not looking for 50,000 years, and that didn't work. So either they're not out there, or it's because we didn't look. And so I always encourage projects which we do search, because I don't know the answer. But we're not going to find out the answer if we don't look for it.
Well, it's the same logic as looking for those near-Earth approaching objects. The chances are small, but the impact would be catastrophic. The impact would be huge. So the implications for finding other intelligent life out there, or even microbial life, are huge, so it's worth the search.
Yes, and, you know, it's not some big multi-billion dollar project. These are modest efforts that don't cost a lot of money, and the potential payoff is huge.
For those who haven't begun looking up at the night sky, but have a good pair of binoculars, most people do, what advice do you give to get someone started to even using a pair of binoculars and see something interesting out there?
All you really need is a star chart. There are charts in my book, or you can download them from the internet for free, or pick up one of the many books or charts that are available. Put a red filter of some kind, as we were saying earlier, on your flashlight. Give your eye enough time to get adjusted to the dark. Try to go to as dark a place as you can, but often, even a downtown backyard, you can still see the brighter constellations. It's nice to take a child along and find your way around. Start learning your way around. If you've got a pair of binoculars, there's a lot you can see. The star clouds, the Milky Way, and the star clusters. It's quite an intriguing hobby. It's very quiet, sort of meditative, and it's easy to get started in it. If you're thinking about getting a telescope, my advice is to go to one of these star parties. Many communities like Seattle, the local amateur astronomers get out there typically every month. They're happy to have guests show up, take a look through several kinds of telescopes, and that's a lot more useful than looking at magazine ads in terms of figuring out what you might like to use and what you can get for the kind of money you want to spend. And
get your feet wet first before diving in.
Yeah, and you know, even like getting started in photography. You know, you don't necessarily want to get a big fancy camera at first. Just get something that'll get you started and see if it sustains your interest.
It's good to know the constellations in the sky, too. I mean, there's so much mythology attached to them. Our ancestors have been looking at those same stars for as long as we've been here. You can also look, you know, make that historical connection, too.
And a sense of the rhythms of the sky. Once you start to become in touch with the phases of the moon and the positions of the planets. And when I was writing Seeing in the Dark, I noted, for instance, that at one point, as I was writing about Jupiter, I could see Jupiter and Saturn in conjunction out through the window. And that close conjunction of those two big distant planets is something that has only happened three times in my lifetime. So it kind of marked off my own history into thirds. And so you get clockworks operating on all different scales.
Well, it is like a big clock, you know, the wheels of the cosmos. And it's interesting to see our universe in that perspective and our place here on Earth in that perspective.
I think it's healthy, you know. I think it's good for humans to understand the truth about things. And the truth is that we grew up here on this one little planet that we don't have anyone to tell us about how we got to be here. We've had to piece the story together for ourselves. And yet, for some reason, we have the ability through science to do that. So it's an exciting adventure. It has only just begun in terms of the scales of human history. Science is only about 400 years old. In that brief period, it has transformed the world. And I think it's too important and too powerful and too interesting to be left entirely to
the scientists.
Professionals. There's no reason why ordinary people. It's like, you know, science to me is like art. There's no reason why you can't make it part of your everyday life, and you're better off for doing so.
Well, you know, we're curious creatures, and we want to know about our landscape around us, and this just helps us expand the territory that we can make our own. So we've talked about looking for other intelligent life out there. Astronomy also gives us new insights into the origins of life, into global warming, earthquake activity, volcanic activity, many things. What are some of the insights that astronomy has lent us in those fields?
Well, volcanoes look a lot different once you start studying other planets.
Like Mars? And
yeah, Mars once had volcanoes, but they seem to have died out. The planet seems to have not had enough.
Left a pretty big one there, though.
Yeah, and it didn't have enough internal heat to sustain, to remain geologically alive. Yet objects like Io, the moon of Jupiter, which is fantastically volcanically active. And once you start to compare the Earth to other planets, then the processes we see around us, hurricanes and volcanoes and earthquakes, really come into focus as planetary processes that distinguish our planet in many ways from its neighbors. So, obviously, this is our survival is at stake here and understanding how our planet works, but it also is just aesthetically rewarding to see the world for what it is. I mean, I think the world as revealed by science is a lot more interesting than, say, the world as it was understood in Dante's time, where you know you really had to imagine a lot of things to create the drama that now we understand to be part of reality.
You know, it's interesting, too, how geological catastrophes and asteroid impacts have really revolutionized the whole study of geology. So the astronomy has just added some big pieces of the puzzle here.
Well, you know, I was listening to one of the tributes to the 9/11, memorials of the 9/11 incident last night done by the Kitchen Sisters here.
Can you speak up just a little bit for us?
Yes, done by the Kitchen Sisters here in San Francisco, and it on it a gentleman said that he had been changed by 9/11 in that he looked at everything more closely now and had more of a sense of the moment because he realized that none of this was going to last forever, and that's what the study of our planet has taught us too. Every moment is unique. The planet has not always been here and has not always been the way it is now. Our tenure on this planet has been brief, and there will never be another moment. There has not been in the past and will never be in the future a moment just like the one you're experiencing now, so you might as well make the best of it.
And appreciate it.
Appreciate it, exactly.
Who are some of your mentors and personal heroes?
Well, I take a, you know, sort of an artist's or scientist's view of the world, which is in some sense exploitive. I'm always looking for what I can use, you know. So, you know, I read Homer every day, I read Proust every day because I can.
It's the English professor in you.
Yeah, well, also because I can learn from them. And
what do you learn?
Well, from those particular writers, I learn what good writing is all about. And from the philosophers, I learn how to make more sense of the world, you know. And if all you do is watch the evening news, the world looks like a house on fire. It doesn't make much sense. But if you study science and philosophy and history and biography, then things do start to make sense. And I think that's makes for a healthier and less crazy way to live. It's not just information that matters. It's how you know, it's the ideas and allow you to make sense of the information. I think that part of the confusion that people have about the world today is that the world has been transformed by science. I don't mean just technology. I'm here looking out in the San Francisco Bay watching a couple of big ships, one on its way to Asia and the other just coming in from Asia on the Yang-Ming line. The technology is evident, but it's really the ideas of science, the scientific method that have transformed the world. And because so few people are comfortable with science, yet they don't understand a lot of these transformations, and it makes the world seem scary and unpredictable, and I'd like to try to rectify that, because I think it's important that we do. Science isn't going to go away, and that if we want things to make more sense, we need to understand it better.
You have taught five disciplines at four universities, so I would assume that the Renaissance men would also be among the heroes, those who took from a number of disciplines to combine a more holistic worldview.
Well, the Renaissance, of course, is important to all of us thinkers. Particularly important to me are the thinkers of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment got kicked off by Isaac Newton's publication of the Principia, which suddenly revealed the underlying causal mechanisms in the solar system and beat back the darkness of superstition that had afflicted the world for over 1,000 years. And there seems to be a popular myth nowadays that the Enlightenment has somehow been discredited or gone past and that we don't need to access those enlightenment ideas anymore. I think that's wrong.
I think we're a continuation of that, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely vital to who we are. A lot of the discussion of the world situation today has been rather muddled by the fact that many Americans have lost a clear vision of what our society is about and what it stands for. Although I think that's changing now in the current situation. There's a new kind of seriousness of intent to
how do you
understand
define
things better.
How do you define our vision here?
Well, I'll start with it's a democratic vision. And democracy, the democratic revolution that transformed the world came right on the heels of the beginnings of science. And that's not an accident. I think that in a real sense, science caused that revolution. And, you know, we need to keep in mind that there's a lot hopeful about the world. If we had been meeting in a coffee shop back when Isaac Newton was alive,
we'd be heretics, wouldn't we?
And I said to you that when this millennium ended, on January the 1st, the year 2000, let's say, that half the people in the world, 48%, would be living in democratic societies, that there'd be hardly any kings left in the world that amounted to anything much or taken very seriously, and that, by the way, no two nations on Earth would be at war with one another on that day. That would have seemed an insanely optimistic thing to say, but that's, in fact, the world we lived in on January the 1st, the year 2000. And so I think that there's a lot of reason to be hopeful about the future if you look at the recent past.
Timothy, thank you for the visit, and thanks for all the work that you're doing. What's in the future for you?
Well, I'm about to go out and go around the country showing some of these beautiful pictures that amateur astronomers can take now. You'd think they were Hubble Space Telescope images. It'd be in Seattle around the
15th, I'll be there. 16th. I want to see this.
Yeah, doing that and see if I can't encourage more Americans to get out, have a look at the night sky, and expand their horizons a bit.
Where do people find your schedule posted on a website?
You can go to my website, timothyferris.com. Send me an email. I'll send you a copy of my itinerary.
Great. Thanks so much. That was Timothy Ferris. Go grab a binoculars. Go find a star party. Borrow a friend's telescope. Go out and do some stargazing. And appreciate this world in which we live, this vast universe, and our place in it. And thanks for listening here today. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com.